Welcome to episode 63 of the Ball Chats podcast. I'm Amelia Earhart. This week I'll be covering the Premier League and Champions League results. I'll also be reviewing Tyson Fury's heavyweight title defence against Dillian White at Wembley Stadium, as well as the rest of the MMA and boxing news in the combat sports section. As you may have surmised, this is Jim speaking, and I am without my brothers in arms. I am Mr. Lonely, as Jimmy Hutton would say, flying solo indeed. Various personal circumstances have kept Bissett and Flynn away this week, and I hope to have them back as soon as possible, if only for the fact I feel like a bit of a nutcase sitting here talking to myself, which is very much the case, judging from our recent listener numbers. Shout out to Paddy Cohen and Tommy Owes. The wonderful Miss Campbell did offer to sit in, but I didn't want to subject her to the footy chat. I might ask her to give her thoughts on the Tyson Fury fight if she's not busy though, because as a consequence of giving up many a Saturday night to my favourite sport, she definitely talks more sense on the topic than Simon Jordan, that's for sure. So, in light of all that, we won't have a top 5 things you might have missed this week. That's more of a bouncing back and forth segment, but we'll keep everything else, and I'll begin with the preamble ramble. And it would just be a brief one on Cristiano Ronaldo, one of the greatest players of our time. After suffering a personal tragedy in the death of his infant son, he's back on the pitch within a week, scoring in two consecutive games, two vital games, one against Arsenal, one against Chelsea. And I just find it astounding that he's able to put that trauma to the back of his mind, step out onto the pitch in front of tens of thousands of people and millions worldwide, and perform to the best of his ability. We often compare Cristiano Ronaldo to Michael Jordan on this podcast, and I think the comparison's very apt in this instance, because Michael Jordan suffered a similar loss in the death of his father just before his first retirement. And, you know, he had the break. He went over to baseball, and when he came back, he had a different shirt number, and there was a lot of adjustment for him, which lasted several years until he was really back on peak Jordan form. But it took Ronaldo 7 days to lace up his boots again and start banging in goals. And I just find that astounding. I don't think that's a usual response. I hesitate to use the word normal, but it's very unusual what Ronaldo's been able to do. And I just have all the respect in the world for him. I don't know whether to rate him or get him sectioned. It's just, I cannot compute that kind of response to that level of personal tragedy. And I hope him and his family are all right. And a very somber note to start us off, but that's been at the forefront of my mind. And I think it was pretty much worth saying for someone who gets a lot of stick. Like, people think he's a bit of a tart, he's cocky, he's arrogant. And he is all those things, to be honest. But I just think he's an astounding athlete with an incomparable level of mental focus for his profession. So with that being said, we'll move on to the footy chat, and Ronaldo will feature a little bit later on, but we'll start off the Premier League results with the title race. And there were a few games last weekend that affected both ends of the table. League leaders Man City, and in particular striker Gabriel Jesus, were emphatic in a 5-0 win over relegation contenders Watford. Jesus struck 4 times in 53 minutes, including a penalty, and Rodri managed to sneak onto the score sheet as well. Hassan Kamara with Watford's only retort when they were 2 goals down. That was a big bully beatdown from the league leaders. And if the transfer speculation has anything to it, and Gabriel Jesus is Arsenal bound, his recent form has got me very much excited if he lands at the Emirates. But in pursuit, Liverpool, they beat local rivals Everton 2-0 at Anfield to stay hot on Man City's heels. Robertson and Origi kept them within a point of the only title contestants. Now, there are only 5 games remaining in the league now. Liverpool have a slightly tougher run-in, on paper at least. Both still have Champions League fixtures to contend with, while Liverpool still have the FA Cup final against Chelsea to consider. Now, I don't know if it's the contrarian in me, but I love seeing two teams that for so long lived in Man United's and Alex Ferguson's shadow, emerging to play some of the best football we've seen in recent years and scooping up trophy after trophy as Man United decline. It makes me feel warm inside. Which moves us on to the top four battle. This has been Arsenal's territory for at least the last 10, 12 years. And I don't want to hark on about this too much, but my Neo in the subway fantasy is looking like it's on the money. Arsenal beat top four rivals Man United 3-1 in an exciting, if scrappy, affair. Nuno Tavares, who turned into more of a defensive liability with every passing moment, opened the scoring in the second minute. Bukayo Saka scored from the spot for the second game running after he was brought down by Telles in the box. Cristiano Ronaldo, as we've mentioned, returning to action only a week after the tragic passing of his infant son, showed just what kind of fortitude he possesses, grabbing a goal for United and his 100th in the Premier League with a deft left-footed finish from Matic's cross. Bruno Fernandes, shockingly, hit the post from the penalty spot after Tavares' senseless handball in the box. And then, after receiving a yellow card for hoofing the ball away at the ref's whistle, another liability, Granit Xhaka received El Neni's layoff about 30 yards out and slammed the ball into the bottom corner to seal the win. It was a game that reminded me why I don't watch full games of football, especially those involving Arsenal, all that often, because it brought more frustration out of me than joy. All in all, the scoreline could have been much different. Ramsdale tipped one shot onto the post. Dalot for United hit the bar twice. Obviously, Fernandes missed that penalty. Tavares dragged someone else down at the edge of the box, and that could have been given easily. On the positive side, though, El Neni and Odegaard were particularly impressive in midfield. But honestly, Ronaldo aside, United were very poor. I don't know the last time Arsenal beat Chelsea and United one week after the next, but this is more of a reflection on a slump in form of the opposition than it speaks to Arsenal's quality. But this is the perfect time to be pulling off these kind of results. And since Tottenham snoozed their way to a scoreless draw against Brentford, the lads are now in fourth place, 2 points ahead of their North London rivals, and it is a great time to be alive. Now, Brentford, after beating Arsenal on the opening day, have gone from the team I despise to very much appreciating, not only for their battling efforts to stay in the league, but this is just what a result against Tottenham. It's so everything's coming together perfectly. But down to the relegation battle, and Norwich lost 3-0 to Newcastle to drive another nail into their Premier League coffin. A Joe Linton double and Guimarães doing the damage for the Magpies. Burnley lifted themselves out of the relegation zone with a 1-0 win over Wolves, while the aforementioned Everton slipped to 18th after their derby defeat at Anfield. Similarly, Watford's woes continue after their drubbing at City, while Leeds grabbed a vital point in a goalless draw with Crystal Palace. Which brings us nicely onto the Champions League, and we'll start with Tuesday night's game between Man City and Real Madrid, which I've heard described as the greatest football game of all time by Bissett, as a matter of fact. And since he's not here to either confirm nor deny, we'll just leave that there. The signs for an exciting game were there from the beginning. Mahrez cut in from the right to tee up De Bruyne's diving header with not even 2 minutes played. 8 minutes later, De Bruyne turned provider, picking out Gabriel Jesus, who turned the defender and slotted his fifth goal in two games past Courtois. There was maybe an element of fortune with his first touch, but it was a very nice finish. City were terrorising Madrid for the first half an hour, until an obscure up-and-comer named Karim Benzema latched onto Mendy's cross and guided the ball into the net with his left foot. It was something out of nothing, and Madrid were very much back in the game. But City were not to be deterred. Mahrez hit the post at the start of the second half, and Foden's follow-up was blocked by Carvajal. But young Phil, with his mental mum, wasn't screwing for long. 5 minutes later, Fernandinho floated one in from the right-hand side, and Foden was there to meet it. Courtois didn't stand a chance from that range. But moments later, Vinicius Jr. conjured the spirit of Gareth Bale, circa 2015. He turned Fernandinho near the halfway line, and he was gone. He made it all the way into City's box and guided the ball past Ederson for a vintage Henry finish. Now, Vinicius Jr. is one of those players, in my mind, very much in the Mbappe and Haaland category, whereby I've been told about their quality, I've been told that they're the next big thing, and I haven't really been that convinced. And this was an instance where he proved me wrong. That was an example of intuitive play, of ridiculous speed and composure for the final product. If he carries on like that, he could be a serious problem for a lot of top level European teams for a long time to come. City again didn't take long to respond. Bernardo Silva playing on after Zinchenko's foul and slamming the ball into the top left hand corner. Courtois stranded. I think on the commentary for the game, they said that Courtois was perhaps distracted by the ref going to blow his whistle, but they're not. But either way, he was left wrong footed and that was a ridiculous finish from Silva. That made it 4-2. However, Real Madrid, who were in their 10th semi-final in 12 years, had one final retort. Laporte handled the ball while battling with Benzema in the box. Madrid were rightly awarded the penalty. Then Big Karim stepped up to the spot to float an audacious Panenka down the middle. Balls of steel on that lad. And the scoring finally stopped there, 4-3 to City going into the second leg. What a game. And the following night, Liverpool and Villarreal had the impossible task of living up to the same standard. And while they didn't quite manage it in terms of goals scored, there was an interesting attack versus defence dynamic to this game that made it fascinating on a completely different level. Now, on paper, this was Liverpool's game all the way. But Villarreal knocked out Juventus and Bayern Munich in the previous knockout stages with stonewall defensive displays. Now still, Mo Salah teed up Mane's header with 11 minutes gone, which ended up skipping wide when by all rights it should have been a goal. Mane returned the favour 15 minutes later, Salah's shot curling over the bar from that little layoff inside the box. Luis Diaz was also a constant threat, cutting in from the left, forcing Villarreal's keeper to parry several times. Mane again came close with a deflected volley from outside the box, but again it went wide. Thiago rattled the corner of the goal frame with a beautiful strike from about 35 yards out. To be honest, the first half saw Liverpool battering Villarreal, but with nothing to show for it. And with Villarreal's habit of nicking goals and keeping clean sheets, the longer the game went, the more concerned Liverpool fans were entitled to be. Fabinho put the ball in the net after the resulting scramble from a corner, but that was ruled offside. In the end, it was Jordan Henderson's deflected cross that found its way into the net with 52 minutes played, the keeper wrong-footed by the flight of the ball and helplessly flapping as it sailed overhead. Anfield went wild, as you might imagine. I think they've got one of the best stadiums and fan bases when it comes to the Champions League in particular. There's just something about that competition and that club that conjures up a very special atmosphere. And that goal proved to be the first crack in the dam, as 2 minutes later, Mo Salah threaded the ball through to Mane on the edge of the box, who poked the ball home into the bottom corner. After almost an hour of giving everything and getting nothing, Liverpool had 2 goals in 2 minutes. Trent whipped one in for Robertson a few minutes after that. He tapped it in for Liverpool's third, only for that to be disallowed as well. The game ended 2-0 to Liverpool, a bad evening for Unai Emery's side, who take the deficit to the second leg at home. They will need something more in attack than they showed here if they hope to progress improbably to the final. And in a competition that's been unusually exciting this year, you've got to ask yourself, who do you favour going into the final? And it's difficult to rule out Man City and Liverpool again. I think City have the tougher task of going to the Bernabeu with only a single goal advantage. If that first leg is anything to go by, that's going to be a straight shootout, because Man City are a team that stick to their playing philosophy, at times to their detriment, but those times are minuscule in compared to the success they draw from sticking to that philosophy. Real Madrid, while not being the force they have been in recent years, and again, I mentioned their 10th semi-final in 12 years. It doesn't ring true what I'm saying, but they were the team at one point, and they aren't that anymore. But still, with Big Karim up front and Vinicius Jr., who for football fans has probably been on the radar for a long time, but for me is a new thing. I think they're very much live in the semi-final. And I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to that game in particular. Not so much the Liverpool-Villarreal one. I do just expect Liverpool to win that game, even if it's a goalless draw, whatever. But on to the final, and hopefully that will be better than last year's. I know City had that misstep that we've harked on about with Fernandinho not starting in the middle of the field and a 1-0 game. I mean, finals tend to be a little bit tight like that, but yeah, I hope City's and Real Madrid's first leg semi-final is influential in how the final might go. Which brings us at breakneck speed to the featured fights for this week. And we'll begin with a retrospective. We'll quickly run through a rather hench list of fights that we previewed last week. Regian. I have no idea how you say that guy's first name, but Ercil, Regian Ercil, defended his lightweight kickboxing world title and continued his unbeaten streak in ONE FC with a unanimous decision over Arian Sadikovic, the taller man with more variety in his work and some horrendous knees to the body throughout. They said it was close. Didn't look that close to me. It was competitive, but Ercil had the edge in every department. Yeah, this was a well-matched fight. Sadikovic wasn't there to lie down. He definitely presented some threats, but there was a clear winner here. And I don't think the instinctive rebuttal of the official decision was warranted. But moving on to the two-day Bellator event in Hawaii, their 278 and 279 events. A very unique format there. I don't know if they were at an army base or something. I probably should have done more research into that, but I think I did read briefly that it was at a US Navy base. But 278, that was last Thursday. And Liz Carmouche upended Juliana Velasquez by TKO in the fourth round with grounded strikes. There was a bit of controversy here, as some people think the strikes weren't damaging enough to warrant a stoppage. But Carmouche had Velasquez completely trapped in a crucifix type hold, which is where she's trapping one arm with her arms and the other arm with her legs. And she freed one of her arms to punch Velasquez in the face repeatedly. They didn't look that damaging to me, and there was only 13 seconds left in the round, so maybe Velasquez could have been given the benefit of the doubt until the break. But that's a judgment call that we each have to make, and I don't think she was getting out of that hold anytime soon. I think it was a fair, if debatable, stoppage. And the following night, Rufian Stutz defended his bantamweight belt, stopping one Arculita in the third with a knee followed by punches. And Chris Cyborg grabbed the unanimous decision win in the main event, keeping hold of her featherweight belt against Arlene Blanco. She dropped Blanco in the fourth. I'll have to go back and check that. But she dropped Blanco with a heavy right hand. And the following ground and pound was brutal, and Blanco did very well to stay defensively responsible in that situation, because the look of shock on her face as she was going down was perhaps indicative of her being completely caught unawares, and to regain her senses that quickly and to fall back on her technique was very impressive, even if she did come out on the losing end. And now across to the UFC, Jessica Andrade grabbed her second win in a row, submitting Amanda Lemos in the opening round of their main event at the UFC Apex on Sunday. A middling card in a sequence of middling cards from the UFC as we build up to UFC 274, headlined of course by lightweight champion Charles Oliveira defending against the war machine Justin Gaethje. Perhaps an unfair comparison considering there was a fighter called War Machine who is now doing probably life in jail after systematically abusing his missus, so I shouldn't apply that moniker to Justin Gaethje. there has been no whispers of that kind of behaviour. But over to the boxing, and the WBO bantamweight champion John Real Casimiro was pulled from his title defence against Paul Butler last Friday, because the British Boxing Board of Control got wind that he was using a sauna to make weight. In stepped Casemiro's sparring partner, Jonas Sultan, who Butler outpointed for the hastily arranged interim belt. Class result for Butler, really. And I hope he and Casemiro can overcome the curse that seems to be on their fight sometime in the future. I'm not quite sure why the British Boxing Board of Control have drawn the line there. I know there's an issue with dehydration and rehydration and the effect that can have on fighters' brain health and their overall well-being. But when you compare what boxers are allowed to do within that sphere to what UFC fighters are allowed to do, I think it's a bit more complicated than basically completely banning saunas altogether. But what do I know? I'm not a scientist, which may shock some of you listening. Which brings us to the big one from last weekend, the triumphant return of the Gypsy King, Tyson Fury, as he defended his WBC and Ring Magazine heavyweight titles via sixth round stoppage against Dillian White in front of 94,000 people in Wembley Stadium. Firstly, what an entrance. Biggie, Kings of Leon, fireworks, a throne, and that final run to the ring, that was a man preparing for war. Fortunately for Fury, the fight never got to that stage. He never had to draw on the resolve that saw him through the first and third fights against Deontay Wilder, because he had Dillian White sussed from 30 seconds in. White tried to unsettle him by coming out as a southpaw, and he landed some good body shots in the first round. Fury just had a look, feinted, jabbed, landed what he had to. By the second, with White back in the orthodox stance, Fury started dismantling him. The few punches White landed did nothing to Fury. And as early as the third round, Dillian White was looking gassed. And I don't mean excited, he was looking dog tired. He tried to focus his attacks on Fury's body. He tried to charge Fury to the ropes. He tried to land with massive swinging overhands, and none of it worked. Fury flicked away with his jab and built up his combinations from there. He landed what he wanted when he wanted. He cut White in the fourth and continued breaking him down until the sixth, when he let go an uppercut that sent the sweat flying from White's head. Then he shoved him away and sent him crashing to the canvas. Now, White did manage to stand at the count of eight, but stumbled when the referee asked him to move, and that was that. Fury dominated him, and it didn't look as if he had to try all that hard to do it. Now, I've heard people express disappointment with the fight. I completely understand that, especially when you consider the level of action that has been in Fury's trilogy against Deontay Wilder. But this spoke to Fury's position in the current heavyweight scene. I think Dillian White would give 9 out of 10 heavyweights a very rough night. And that includes AJ. That includes Deontay Wilder. I'm not saying he would win those fights. I'm saying he would be in there and he would make them work very, very hard to beat him. Now, you might look at the Alexander Povetkin fight and say, oh, a 40-year-old guy knocked him out. That was a perfect combination in a fight that Alexander Povetkin was handily losing. And White is susceptible to the uppercut. All fighters have deficiencies. But I truly believe that White is a problem for most fighters. And Fury just treated him like he was a novice. And on that stage, in that arena, you know, it was a very mature performance from Tyson Fury. And on that form, I don't think you could pick many people to beat him. I don't think you could pick anyone to beat him right now. That's a bold claim, because anytime you start wholeheartedly believing in someone's invincibility, inevitably they get beaten in turn. But AJ couldn't deal with Fury right now. No way. I think Usyk presents more problems. But depending on how their rematch goes, I do think Usyk will beat AJ in the rematch. Whether it's in Saudi, whether it's in Kyiv, whether it's in London. I just think he's got his number. And I would be more intrigued to see how that fight plays out after Fury's win against White than I would be to see Fury fight AJ, because I think, I don't want to say mismatch, because I do rate AJ. I don't go in for this, he hasn't got a chin, he's this, he's that. It's very easy to criticise fighters after high profile losses. I think he's top level, but it just so happens that the level above him is where Tyson Fury lives. Now, after the win against Dillian White, Fury said he's still planning to retire, but then in the next breath, he pulled UFC heavyweight champion Francis Ngannou out of his pocket, and the pair of them started to say they wanted some hybrid rules fight, like boxing rules but with MMA gloves. I don't know how that would work, or if that would work, or is that a risk worth taking? I do think Fury would absolutely school him, to be honest, because in terms of footwork and in terms of movement and in terms of fitness, Francis Ngannou is very much a plodding, swinging from the hip type boxer. And Fury will just see that shit coming. If he can deal with Deontay Wilder, the most devastating one-punch knockout artist, maybe in history, a one-trick pony, but it's a good trick. I don't see how Fury would fail to deal with Francis Ngannou unless he fails to mentally prepare. But that was my fear coming into this fight against Dillian White, and look what he did. Absolutely scored him. So enough of the Tyson Fury nut-hugging. But before we finish on that review, I want to give a shout-out to Nick Ball, who terrorised Isaac Lowe on the undercard, stopping him in the sixth round after a merciless succession of hard punches. I'd never heard of this guy before. He was like a lit stick of dynamite, word to Michael Chandler, and I look forward to seeing him again. Now we'll move on to the look ahead, and we'll stick with the boxing for the time being. This Saturday, it's the battle of the boxing hotties. Katie Taylor versus Amanda Serrano for the undisputed lightweight championship of the world at Madison Square Garden. Now I don't mean to diminish them as fighters by referring to them as hotties. I just think they're both rather attractive. This is, outside of Savannah Marshall versus Clarissa Shields, this is probably the biggest fight in women's boxing. In Katie Taylor, you've got a beloved sportswoman in Ireland, probably worshipped, idolized, an Olympic gold medalist, a pioneer in the sport. She's one of the forerunners of having women's boxing introduced into the Olympics. She's undefeated in 20 fights as a pro, despite a couple of close calls against Delphine Passoon. Serrano, who I've not seen that much of outside of a few highlights, her record stands at 42-1-1 with 30 KOs. Now, I'm not sure about the quality of her opposition, but on paper, that's a very impressive record. She seems to be a fast starter and a very big hitter. This is a significant step forward in the progression of women's boxing, because regardless of the running order on BoxRec, I think these two are going to headline at Madison Square Garden. This is a big thing. Madison Square Garden isn't as big of a deal as it used to be, but for people who are interested in the history of boxing, that was the place to be, especially in the 30s and 40s, which is one of the golden eras in the sport. And I think it's a great symbolic arena to be holding this fight in. And on the undercard of that, Liam Smith versus Jesse Vargas. These are two quality, durable operators fighting at 154 pounds, which I believe favours Smith, because he has, outside of one or two fights, campaigned there his whole career. Jesse Vargas was probably at his best at 140, 147. But I really like Vargas, and I think anyone who's interested in him should go back and watch his fight against Mikey Garcia, because that's a very good example of his qualities coming into that fight. And I expect that to be a decent scrap. It will probably go the distance. I don't think Vargas has got the firepower to stop Smith. And I think Vargas has a good enough chin to stand up to Liam Smith. Liam Smith deserves a lot of credit. He comes from a family of four boxing brothers. The real hype was around Callum Smith. But I think Canelo, I don't want to say exposed, because that diminishes his past achievements. But outside of the win against George Groves in the Super 6 finals, and George Groves was heavily compromised by a shoulder injury in that fight, I don't think Callum Smith's resume is that impressive compared to Liam Smith's. Both of them have fought Canelo, and Callum Smith did manage to go the distance, but in a very reticent, safety-first performance. Liam Smith got stopped in the ninth round, but he went toe-to-toe with Canelo, like gave him real problems. Maybe not on the verge of stopping him or beating him, but he was competitive in every exchange. And according to Liam Smith, he hadn't sparred at all going into that fight, and I think he deserves a lot of credit. I think he recently lost a split decision to the Russian, whose name is escaping me off the top of my head. But if you're losing split decisions in Russia, you probably won the fight. He also lost to Jaime Munguia, got dropped once or twice, battling to the end. I've got a lot of admiration for Liam Smith, even if he hasn't been able to beat the elite of the elite. But then 9 out of 10 fighters lose to the elite of the elite. you see his level when he drops down to fight people like Sam Eggington, who I also am a big fan of, but he has his limitations. I'm not a big fan of Anthony Fowler, and Liam Smith absolutely dealt with him. I think he'll be remembered fondly. Well, he will be by me at least. Well, on that same night as Katie Taylor and Amanda Serrano make history at Madison Square Garden, Shakur Stevenson and Oscar Valdez put their respective super featherweight titles on the line at the MGM Grand in Las Vegas. This is a matchup that I think both fighters deserve a lot of credit for. So often in boxing, you see these undefeated guys at the top level circling around each other, trying to marinate the fight and squeeze every last penny out of it. These two have said, fuck it, let's see who's the best guy, and I'll rate them for it. I think that Oscar Valdez is severely overrated. He's still a top level fighter, but I think the knockout against Berchelt, moving backwards, overhand right, clean knockout, beautiful knockout really, I think that flattered him. I think he lost against Conceição, the Brazilian. And that was in the midst of that PED scandal where the WBC said, oh, you've tested positive, but fuck it, we'll let you fight. It's not that I've got a problem with him using PEDs. Anyone who listens to the podcast will know that my stance on PEDs is this. I think it's a hilarious line to draw when these guys are punching the fuck out of each other for half an hour on the night, regardless of all the sparring they do, regardless of all the training they do, the damage that they cause themselves in making weight. You can't put this substance in your body. I find it ridiculous. It's a arbitrary line to draw. That's not my problem with Oscar Valdez. My problem is the preferential treatment he received by the WBC. And then the preferential treatment he got on the night against Conceição. I think he got boxed up. Yeah, he finished strong. So what? He lost, for me, he lost like 7 of the first 9 rounds. So, you know, that's not to diminish him. He's still up there. He still beats most fighters. His fight against Scott Quigg was ridiculous, and I think he beat him with a broken jaw as well. I'm not diminishing him. I think he's obviously tough. He's obviously a big puncher, but he falls into that category of preferential treatment that I just don't like. And all that being said, I think Shakur Stevenson is going to box his head off. Shakur Stevenson's balance, his fluidity, the way he's able to throw punches with no signals, the way he's able to readjust when he misses a shot. I think this is going to be a one-sided fight. Now, I'm happy to be proven wrong. If it's more competitive, all the better for me. But I just don't see how Shakur Stevenson gets beat here. I just don't see it. But we'll see. I'm looking forward to that fight. I'll be watching it on Sunday morning. But over to MMA. The only card of note is the UFC's Apex show on Sunday, headlined by Rob Font and Marlon Vera, who sit 5th and 8th in the bantamweight rankings respectively. Font is on a good run. He's beat Marlon Moraes and former champion Cody Garbrandt in his last two fights, while Vera bounced back from his 2020 defeat against Jose Aldo with wins over Davy Grant and Frankie Edgar. That Edgar KO is rough. Check it out. It's a front kick to the chin that rearranged Edgar's face. And don't forget, Vera took out Sugar Sean O'Malley when he was still undefeated, which is something that Sean O'Malley's gone on to completely repudiate in an effort to keep his image alive. He's another one that receives a lot of preferential treatment, and I don't rate him all that highly. He looks good in matchups that favour his style, in matchups where he has a massive size advantage, which might always be the case because he's so tall and thin and lean, but I'm not saying he can't develop and he can't add tools to his game where he would be a threat to those top five. But I think, like, if you put him against someone, even Dominic Cruz would cause him problems. Dominic Cruz is getting old now. He's like in his 40s. But prime Dom would have fucked him up. I think Rob Font would cause him problems with that long jab. I think Corey Sandhagen, he's the apex version of Sean O'Malley. I think Sandhagen would dust him. I think the Jose Aldo fight would be pretty good for a lot of reasons. But again, Jose Aldo, this is like an aging division. TJ Dillashaw, he'd bust up Sean O'Malley, but he's getting older now. He's like 35, 36. Saying nothing about Petey Yan. He's an absolute animal. And the champion, Aljamain Sterling, after that incredible performance against Petey Yan in their rematch. I don't think that's a conversation even worth having. And that brings us to the end of the podcast. thank you very much for listening in, and I hope one voice instead of three hasn't been too tiresome. Next week it will be more of a collaborative effort, I'm sure, even if it's just a two-man show instead of one. But again, thank you very much, and do hit us up on the Insta if you're interested at all. I'm also on Twitter, Jim_ballchat. I'm not really on there that much, but if I start getting notifications, I will interact. And that's it. Until next week, have a good one. Take care of yourselves.